Good morning, hello, good evening, good day, whatever time of day it is that you're actually listening to this. It is Maggie for Call Me Maggie, and I'm bringing you another knowledge gathering episode. I'll be utilizing a diagram in this talk, so you will want to have a picture of the diagram probably in front of you when I get to that area, because it's a little hard to explain or to describe, but I'll do my best. Today's knowledge gathering episode is called Beholding the Beheld. One of the first ways I ever heard Professor Richard Owsley say something highly critical about another thinker involved a colleague the owl had known for decades. We bumped into the fellow on UNT campus when we were walking back to Terrell Hall from Wooten Hall, where we had just finished a great books program class. They chatted for a bit. Owsley asked his mix of personal info and probing questions. The fellow told his thoughts. We parted politely and continued walking to the philosophy department. That's when Owsley turned to me and said, "Brown, that man has hardening of the categories. A brilliant mind blocked, unteachable anymore. And there's nothing more pitiful nor more dangerous than a smart person who becomes unteachable. They are effectively unreachable." Category originates in ancient Greece, denoting a way of making a public claim of wrongdoing. Categorein may be translated literally as to down publicly, to talk down publicly, or maybe in Texas we'd say to publicly bring down or maybe even put down. Thus, it is the cause for which a person should be prosecuted. Socrates was literally categorized as an impious atheist whose very presence corrupted youth and subverted the good of Athens. The action's original sense of airing a public charge weakened down toward asserting an understanding about a thing or to naming the kinds of stuff in a collection. So by the time Aristotle was teaching how to codify a logical structure of things, he used the term to point to the highest notion that gave meaning to a class of different substances. And we have pretty much meant this by category since the Abrahamic theologians of the late Middle Ages took up Aristotle to elucidate the natural world in relation to Torah, Bible, and Quranic studies. The thing about categories as a means of calling out and of organizing is how incredibly practical they can be. Categorizing helps in developing a taxonomy of processes in the natural world, assists in codifying an order of values in society at large, and even aids in developing a narrative of meanings from personal experience. Unfortunately, precisely because they are useful, they are prone to making do. People make do with the categories they have at hand rather than investigating new ones, we might call that creative thinking, dispensing with old ones, that might be the process of critical thinking, and reactivating forgotten ones or historical research or historical thinking. This, and of course there are many other kinds. This contributes, this, when I say this here, I mean this tendency of just taking up some categories that are pre-fabricated and making do with them. It contributes to the reification of categories into things that exist, whether or not humans fabricate them. And while some aspects of the physical world definitely show a tendency toward obtaining, even if we do not know about them, I mean, you know, it's not like gravity wasn't there until it was finally described as part of the process of motion by Isaac Newton. It's not like relativity wasn't there until it was described by Isaac Einstein. So, you know, the physical world is a world that's delimited and finite, and has a lot of predictability to it. So categories there tend to not change quite as much, but there's also a possibility that we're miscategorizing something as natural that's not natural. That's not something that just appears in nature, but it's an outcome of social engineering or something like that in among human beings. And yes, I understand human beings are natural and human beings are in nature. I'm now talking about when human beings come up with something, create something, and then act like it sort of evolved in nature or was created by God to be part of nature rather than an artifice of being human. So let me go ahead and backtrack a little bit. While some aspects of the physical world definitely show a tendency toward obtaining, even if we don't know about them, that is not the same thing as the rigor mortis exhibited by some people concerning social and personal categories that simply are nothing more than an uncritical imposition of those people's opinions onto the entirety of reality. Now, I decided to call this knowledge gathering segment Beholding the Beheld. This gets at the reflective need to still self-awareness in order to look upon the tension between the myriad possibilities within everyday circumstances, and the impossibility of imagining an authentic freedom that transcends them, that transcends these everyday circumstances. So our everyday circumstances are where we find our actualities, the things that we've actualized out of our possibilities. We find and we can expect the possibilities that we're familiar with. But authentic freedom or transcendence actually is an impossibility because whatever authentic freedom is, it's not something that we've necessarily experienced. So it doesn't actually fit into our pre-established notions. So that's the real tension for us in thinking about how we know what we behold and how we're held by that knowledge, held by the power of, how we're interacting with the world. So there's chance now. Let's get up and go forward to gather. I ask, what holds us? Well, always already being holds us. To be holds us. And how do we hold ourselves? Through social being, social existence. But too often that gets held up by the constraints of ideology. And here, ideology is the account of the interconnected ideas, meaning intersubjective cultural and personal doctrines, rather than empirically verifiable facts or logically demonstrable relations. In other words, ideology is a belief system. The commonly held biases, prejudices, presuppositions, traditions, and customs that justify and explain the everyday goings on, the structure of the everyday goings on within a particular community. The notion actually was invented at the turn of the 19th century to denote a new conception for studying ideas. In literally, ideology means an account of ideas or a study of ideas. In that sense, it's commonly used to talk about a close account of ideas at work in European political structures. This is how Karl Marx uses the term. As a regular occurrence in political philosophy after the turn of the 20th century, socialists, communists, and anarchists, later fascists as well, used the term to denote the scientific, therefore universal, validity of their own doctrines against the unscientific, therefore provincial, invalidity of the diverse capitalist colonial regimes controlling Europe and the United States. As the socialistic surge progressed around the world and empires regressed to a point, the term came to be applied by revolutionaries and academics as imperialist ideologies, meaning all of the older forms of economic governance, both the post-colonial holdovers of European conquest in places like India and Africa and South America, and the administrative organizations of the old Ottoman, Chinese, and Japanese empires. By the time 2001 arrives, ideology stands as a kind of political commitment, the networked belief system that people work within. The ideology currently most apparent in the daily happenings, executive policies, and common laws within the United States is neoliberalism, a term that I want to get out of using because it's so abstract, so I often replace it now with the idea of Emperor Palpatine, that you actually get a good notion of the the evolution from industrial colonial capitalism to neoliberal network capitalism over the course of the 40 years that the Skywalker saga was being filmed. And because neoliberalism is such an abstraction, and this is one of our problems, is that we begin to treat abstractions like they're real things, or we start talking in abstractions and real people don't really understand what the fuck we're talking about. So anyway, the ideology currently most apparent in the daily happenings, executive policies, and common laws within the United States is neoliberalism, or the emperor, as I like to say now. This emperor ideology takes as axiomatic that markets are generated by human beings to meet the needs of large and diverse populations. Markets are the best way to get from people what they can offer to the world system and deliver unto people what they need or want. Markets must not be protected by trade barriers. Rather, they must be protected by well-trained managers, technocrats, who are sensitive to the cohesion of markets, the logistics of exchange, the intersection of cultures, and the desires of consumers. In other words, the dominant ideology, the emperor, is about controlling networks. Better, it is about networks of control. This has been evolving for a long time in the United States. After all, if Ortega y Gasset is correct that we hold ideas but we inhabit beliefs, indeed, we are our beliefs, it takes time for the notions that we hold to become the dogmas that we inhabit and that thereby hold us. Or more poetically, it takes a moment for what we behold through our ideological commitments. It takes a moment for what we behold to become how we are beheld. Now, I confess I have an ulterior motive for sharing this with you today. Right now, the state of Texas is being held up by the Republican farty, as I like to call them, in order to criminalize whatever does not fit into their own ideologies. Texas politicians are playing with the lives of some beautiful people right now, and is not only wrongheaded, I think it's utterly evil. If you live in Texas or if your family lives in Texas, I really am doing this today to call you out and ask you to please organize with friends to contact the offices of state representatives and senators to let them know you do not support these efforts. Specifically, these conservative politicians criminalize parents seeking recognized professional help from physicians and therapists for assisting transgender children on their path to authentic self-expression. There are different bills that would take away the licenses of medical and counseling professionals who offer any therapy for trans children. They've also written provisions that will make it impossible for trans children to compete in UIL sports, and they've written provisions that make seeking help by parents for their kiddos an act of child abuse that would end in the parents being fined, possibly going to jail, and definitely losing custody of their transgender children. So our knowledge hunting today lays out the need to disrupt the categories hardened into ideologies of social exclusion and hyper-individualism. These promote vast disparities between people politically and economically. Leftists are not crazed equalizers, as most represent us to be. I'm okay with slight disparities among folks, where some have a bit more than they need. The condition for this, however, is that no one else is lacking in the material means to succeed, nor the spiritual means to thrive. Where's the justice in many folks going thirsty, hungry, or homeless, while a few folks have enough for dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of people? Where's the justice when one group is perceived as natural and therefore normal and normalizing, while another is labeled unnatural, thus abnormalizing? When sociopolitical systems favor one category of people over all others, there will be perforce toxic disparities, precisely because rigid binaries by custom get treated as natural opposites, where one side must dominate the other because nature is a war of each against all. In order to gather up a better awareness, I will take us through a diagram I've created, the one I mentioned earlier, to lay out the relationships between truth, beauty, and joy as rational expressions of differing kinds of certainty that we can possess. This is based off of my studies of intellectual history, and I do filter this through my usual lenses of Carl Jaspers' existential philosophy and the thinkering of Taoism. My hope is that the exercise will help folks grasp creative ways for reflecting on what they understand, how they believe, and where we encounter the limits of comprehension. But first, I have a little poem that I wrote last summer to set the stage. Where does mastery reside? Neither in some master nor in some reserve of wisdom. Rather, mastery happens as joyful abandon on the threshold between actuality and possibility. No master possesses knowledge. Knowing knows as limit, as differentiating. No tradition stores wisdom. Powering powers as boundless as transcending. Ever between, yet never where, eventfulness. This poem points towards the diagram. If you look at the diagram that I've included with the blog post, the podcast post, what you'll see is two lines, a green line on the bottom and a red line at the top. With a circle in the middle, a circle of arrows between the two, delimiting a space, clearing. The bottom line, the green line, I've chosen green for nature, is nature. It qualifies as the realm of knowledge, the realm of metabole, of moving beyond the moment of being alive, of the organic. And we know this realm is the base realm of determined, limited being, the cosmos, the world, life, nature, all of that good stuff. This realm we can call the Gnostic realm because it is a realm in which understanding can be put forward, knowledge comes forth as logically valid relations through deduction and as experimental validation of matters through induction. Now what's going on is everybody shares this same common earth world, right? This determined limited being. What we're trying to do as a group of entities, as human beings, but also as ourselves, is to move through the use of our ability to compare and contrast and think, through the use of our reason, try to move from knowledge to non-knowledge. And non-knowledge is what I was talking about earlier when I talked about the impossible. It's not that, so we can, in a sense, we can know that there is something called freedom, but it's impossible to possess knowledge of being free in an abstract way. It can only be an experience. So, in talking about the impossibility of in thought of authentic freedom, not that it would not be something that could happen, but that until it happens, it's always an imagination. It's always something that will probably fall short of the reality. So when we talk about that impossibility, we're talking about something for which we have non-knowledge. Okay, only the supposition. So we move by reason from knowledge to non-knowledge and back from non-knowledge to knowledge
through interesting experiences. So we have lots of different things happen to us. It's, as William James would call it, a blooming, buzzing confusion the world is. And all of this stuff is happening, but the things that catch our interest, the things that hold our attention, the things we care about, those would be our interesting experiences. That's the realm where we're aware of what's going on, right? Where we're aware of how the world is turning and all of that. So in our diagram, that would be the circle of the clearing created by a circle of arrows, which I've labeled consciousness. Consciousness is, in a sense, a kind of stasis. It's not a stasis in the sense that it's static, it doesn't move. Consciousness obviously is always moving. In fact, the whole point of creating consciousness as a clearing demarked by a circle of arrows is to get to the notion that consciousness temporally is always moving, in a sense, in the same direction as determined limited being of nature that we can know and understand. But in consciousness, that's the word stasis actually originally was the Greek word for civil war. And that term then here would mean that when we're in this realm, we're making appeals between the different things that hold us in a kind of tension, right? So stasis was one of the Greek words for civil war because two opposing parties, at least two opposing parties, would be so equally matched that they would kind of bring everything to a standstill. So in consciousness, we're really sort of talking about how we stand together and the things that we can find from the subjective side and the objective side that come together and sort of make a world that we can make sense of, a world that appeals to us. While demonstrable understanding, or the relations of ideas, logically stand so long as the axioms themselves are clearly utilized, assertive understanding, or matters of fact, logically stands until more evidence confirms or denies the assertion. So in the realm of nature, in the realm of metaboly, the thing on which we can stand is, really, you could say, mathematics, which is the expression of the relation of ideas, and empirical science, and common sense, which are the expression of assertions of understanding or matters of fact. And those work so long as there's evidence for them. And if there's counter evidence, then, you know, the assertion has to be adjusted or even denied. So this is the stuff that we can commonly agree on. We should commonly agree on. The biggest problem we have is that when we move up into that realm of interesting experiences, into that realm of the beautiful, the pathic realm, the realm where we suffer as human beings, where we suffer through our humanity. It's the pathic realm, the realm of believing. So we all stand on the ground of understanding. That's what we all share. But we're doing all of that inside of a consciousness where we're often explaining the world through our beliefs. An active life is a commitment to our beliefs, right? The vita activa of the ancients, the active life is a commitment to that. It's where our axiology or our values occur. So the beautiful as the pathic realm, this middle realm of the clearing circle of consciousness caught between the unconscious, which is forgotten, and the unconscious, which hasn't been noted yet. The beautiful is this pathic realm of believing, of vita activa, of active life, as axiological or virtue or values, excuse me. Active life is axiologically appealing relations, which we get through certain kind of reductions, and as rhetorical appeals to matters, which we get through a kind of conductive thinking or conductive rhetoric. Belief has an aesthetic component based upon like or dislike. So a lot of times We may not believe something simply because we don't like it, not because, right? So we may not actually believe something that's a fairly clear understanding. I know growing up in Waxahachie, one of the things that was fascinating to me was how biblical literalists needed to come up with, they just simply did not believe in evolution. They didn't like the whole idea. They mischaracterized it constantly because they didn't like the idea, and their beliefs got in the way of, you know, what was becoming, what had become fairly agreed upon scientific understanding. And, you know, to me, this brings up a lot of what I would call rhetorical questions, right? So it's kind of the realm of rhetor, the realm of consciousness, the realm of beauty, the pathic realm of believing, of active life is a kind of a rhetorical realm. And it brings up a lot of rhetorical questions to be asked about to ourselves. Toward what are we more likely to turn? The things that we like or the things that we don't like? How are some experiences untoward, upsetting, harmful, even ugly to the point that we just simply want to deny them or turn away from them? They don't fit into our worldview. Can we go onward with our understanding, with our shared understanding, our shared ground of the limited, determined being? Can we go onward with our understanding if we begin selectively ignoring data that weakens a commonly accepted, quote, fact, unquote? When something we find beautiful distorts the truth of our understanding, where is the meaning of our striving after a good life? And that kind of brings us to what I call the joyful realm or the Bothic realm. So we were dealing with the Gnostic, Greek to know, the Pathic, Greek to suffer or passion, and the Bothic, Greek for depth. Right, it goes down, it has a profundity to it, it shows you something deep. And that's the upper realm, which in the diagram is the upper limit that determines sort of the limits of consciousness. So if consciousness is on the ground of nature that we all share, and if consciousness is just beneath the heaven or the sky of the transcendent as undetermined, unlimited being, that which we're not familiar with, this would be the realm of the joyful. And it's a very personal realm because it's not the realm that's shared by everybody. Everyone gets to transcendence in different ways. There's no one way to get there. So joyful as the Bathic realm, the deep realm, the profound realm, the realm for comprehending, the vita contemplativa, the contemplative life, which is ontologically grasping relations or abduction, and existentially grasping onto matters or transduction. So basically what we have here are the ways that we can be led along the ground of understanding through deduction and induction through the realm of believing through reduction and conduction and beyond the realm of comprehending abduction and transduction. And reason connects all of these realms together, the truthful Gnostic realm, the beautiful Pathic realm, the joyful Bathic realm. Reason connects all of the three realms in tension with each other through comparison and contrast as evaluation and through imagination. And it connects all of those aspects of our thinkering, our ability for thinkering together alongside the being world or the cosmos and transcendent being or the realm of, you know, full liberation, the impossible. The importance of making these distinctions centers on not confusing the expressions of truth, of beauty, and or of joy. Truth collects data in probable natural arrangements to explain and to predict. But beauty collects items in interesting social arrangements to appreciate and to persuade. While joy collects feelings in fascinating personal arrangements to elucidate and to contemplate. We can talk about ideas and facts that are proper to each kind of arrangement. But an idea or a fact derived from the exploration of nature as material reality, it's not the same thing as ideas or facts shared from the expression of culture as a social reality, nor is it the same as the ideas or facts grasped from the excitement of self as personal reality. We can talk about the relations of ideas and the matters of facts in each realm, but each area has different means for establishing them as proper to the realm. And it's very slippery, really, since, you know, whenever you're doing something in English that requires that you make sure this is, you know, that you put adjectives or adverbs in there to make sure it's qualifying what you're talking about. And it, there are a lot of people who just talk about ideas and facts and they don't qualify. I'm talking about scientific ideas and facts. I'm talking about artistic ideas and facts. I'm talking about spiritual ideas and facts. They don't put those adverbs or those adjectives in there, and then that means that you get a lot of slipperiness inside of, you know, whatever conversations might be being had among people. Going back into ideologies which drive us in our social political commitments, we should think about law. The first step to deconstructing any trauma-inducing superstructure is recognizing the difference between the kinds of forces that bind the cosmos and those customs that delimit a society. We refer to both as laws. And the word law is interesting. It comes to us from Latin lex. Latin lex comes to us through the word for reading and speaking. And from Greek, legain, to speak, to say, and logos, the word. So a law is a guiding word, right? This is extremely important to understand. The Stoics were the first people to say there must be natural laws. And they did this by analogy, right? They did this by analogy wherein they looked at, you know, what it meant to be a Roman. And they realized that the Romans had a law of the kind of person, a law of the Roman, right? So they had the Lex Romana, they had, or the Lex Urbana, the law of the city. They had the Lex Gentile, they had the Lex of the, you know, they had the law of the non-Romans. So they also had another law that was the law of the gods, and they had another one that was the law of fate, and there was another that was basically, you know, every area had its own laws. The Romans were extremely legalistic. Anyway, the Stoics were like, so, you know, that's a handy way to talk about how the cosmos works, right? The Stoics believed in providence, providentia. So they may not have believed in a god or in a necessarily or in the pantheon of gods, but they picked up this idea that there's something that sees ahead. So therefore they talked about the lex natura. Okay, and like I said before, these laws, this term comes from lege and logos. So it's the first kind of law, natural laws, by analogy, and the second, however, describes our organizing process among people. Legal, that's another, you know, lex word. Legal codes are legends, and legend is another lex word, right? Legal codes are legends that we use to keep order among ourselves. While a natural force will stay operative so long as all the cosmic conditions are stable, a social custom only operates so long as the legendary conditions hold. And you can see this also in Plato's laws. He says no law works if there's not a shared legend to go along with it. And I've always said that one of the reasons that our laws for the drug war did not work very well is that we all have very different legends about marijuana and the different kinds of drugs that have been made illegal. We have different stories, different approaches. And we live in a point now where the national drug policy makes no sense at all because everyone's decided that they believe the legend that marijuana is so awesome that it's just God's drug or whatever. So that's a, that's a good example, I think, of partially what we're talking about. So let me go back a little bit. While a natural force will stay operative so long as all the cosmic conditions are stable, a social custom only operates as long as the legendary conditions hold. A change in the shared world will lead to changes in the mutual conditions. For some, there can be pliability in the shared stories, so long as the big narrative stays relatively similar, and especially if they do not see themselves as losing out all that much. In other words, so long as people can be indifferent, right? People will be indifferent so long as you're not really asking a lot about them, and they'll be supportive in some kind of way. So in this kind of regard, you can say Anglo-Saxon Protestants can accept that Irish and Polish Catholics are white if it helps white supremacy maintain control over people of color. Or white women professionals can turn a blind eye to racism, homophobia, transphobia in the workplace, whether it's a university or a corporation or a government office. White women professionals can turn a blind eye to these kinds of things if it means they keep themselves progressing in their careers. And good straight Christians that I've known in my life broaden their view of homosexual relationships so long as those folks uphold the authority of the church while sustaining the heteronormative notion that there are only two genders. Hell, some neoliberals can go along with aspects of socialism so long as it keeps the capital networks connected and well-managed and profits efficiently flowing. Nonetheless, there are few for whom the slightest critique to customary arrangements marks an existential threat to order itself. Why? Because they interpret the legends literally. And if you've grown up in Texas, especially if you grew up with Miwoxahatchee and you did any kind of classes with Doc Hastings or anything like that, you know, that creationist stuff I was talking about earlier, they interpret Genesis absolutely literally. Okay? They interpret the legends literally. They will do everything within their power to confirm the biases empowered by those tales. They will mix science and religion, and that was the case with a lot of creationists. I can say that. They got a little more sophisticated between the time I was in high school and the time I was working in college. They'll mix science and religion haphazardly to get their answer. They will deny scientific facts if that helps their position. Then if they need to, they'll turn around and deny religious doctrines when those do not suit their purpose. All the while, their main concern focuses on privileging their own interpretation of the world over anyone else's. They render their opinions with authoritarian ease because they self-identify as the defenders of truth, the defenders of the legend, the defenders of the law needing to be updated. The second group reminds me of something that once happened back in 1984 when I was studying with the Augustinians in Mexico. We were going up a mountain near Mexico City to see a total eclipse. Around each great bend in the mountain road, there was a small station where folks could park to see the views. In these spaces around every turn, lots of people were outside celebrating masses. I turned to my spiritual counselor at the time, the prior of the seminary, "What's this?" And he blushed. He actually blushed and said, They're saying masses and praying rosaries to the sun so that the sun comes back after the eclipse. Some of the priests saying the masses did believe this. Some just went along because it would settle down the peasants. The reason I'm reminded is because this practice of religious intercession connects back to ancient Tenochtitlan and the Aztecs. They believed that their world system was kept afloat by divine mandate to sacrifice human lives. Why? So the Aztecs would always be victorious as those who make the hard decision for what is needed so the sun does not go away and never come back. People who, quote, honestly, unquote, are true believers in old social customs that are expressions of the quote, real order, unquote, of the cosmos. They are willing to sacrifice whatever lives they need to offer up as a holocaust in order for their sun to keep coming back, for the light to keep shining on their precious world system that affirms them, that upholds them. They will kill to not be wrong. Let's say that again. These people will kill to not be wrong. I say it a third time. They will kill to not be wrong. The greatest danger for groups marginalized because of previous social customs happens at the intersection of the bad faith, so long as I don't lose out in different actors, and the falsely authentic, I know the will of God, I know the will of nature, I know the will of the founders, fanatics. And that is what is happening right now with all these families in Texas and other states, about 20, where fanatics have decided that they know better than medical experts and they know better than the involved parents of transgender children. They are treating transgender kids and their families as sacrificial victims to make sure the sun keeps shining on the perverted, decaying world system. Those politicians have to be stopped at every turn when they legislate hate, when they continue the legend of hatred. Their ministers that minister to them have to be shouted down and deplatformed whenever they preach fear, whenever they imbue the legends of fear. These bigots have to be shamed into fearing something bigger than just having a social custom change that might make their life a little less certain. Every bully that lasts a while, like every tyrant, has people who go along with them until, for whatever reason, they do not any longer. A quick review of 5,000 years of human history demonstrates there is no convincing a fanatic. But it also shows that there is scaring bad faith actors. There is frightening bad faith actors. Nobody who acts in bad faith actually is willing to die for a belief that they actually do not believe. And without bad faith allies, fanatics have no real power. My plea to you today is to go out and do more knowledge gathering about this situation with these families and our transgender siblings who just want to live a life of authentic self-expression. And I implore you to reach out to your state representatives to oppose these moves by members of Texas state legislature. I'll put up some things that give you more info about the bills that are in Congress right now in Texas. And maybe some phone numbers, at least a picture with phone numbers of people you can reach out to and leave a comment. I will be, let yourself be heard and speak out for these kids. You hear the truth about our human condition and nature. You live the beauty of equity among neighbors. You embrace the joy of self-expression. Let's help transgender children in Texas and around the United States and all of their families find all of this too. Let us behold them such that they know they're being held close by us throughout this discouraging struggle. Once again, where does mastery reside? Neither in some master nor in some reserve of wisdom. Rather, mastery happens as joyful abandon on the threshold between actuality and possibility. No master possesses knowledge. Knowing knows as limit as differentiating. No tradition stores wisdom, powering powers as boundless as transcending. Ever between, yet never where, eventfulness. I love all of you, and I look forward to all of the great work that I know that you're going to do your part to help out with this. And remember, stay limber in your mind. Do not fall prey to the hardening of categories.